Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. In the studios of CBS Interactive today, Executive Chairman of Media Brands, Henry Tager.
Hi, Tim.
As well as PR guru, Scott Rohde.
Hey, Tim.
And to complete the full house today, Mumbrella Deputy Editor, Robin Hicks.
Hi, Tim.
This week, PR expertise in media agencies. Whatever next? The Battle of 10 and 7 continues. Disaster coverage and the somewhat distasteful battle for credit. More about the Angry Boys with Chris Lilly and the narcotic that is social media. So Henry, welcome back to the podcast. Last time you were mainly wearing your MFA hat, president of the Media Federation. Today, I guess it's a chance to chat a bit about media brands and get your views on the week's media events. For you as a business, how is 2011 so far?
2011's great. We've definitely jumped out of the gates really fast, and the market has continued that pace, I guess, from the moment we all got back from having a Christmas break. And what it really sort of talks to is every year the market pace and the market complexity is actually creating a whole new level of excitement in all of our businesses. So really happy with the way we've started. Lots of interesting and exciting things in the pipeline, and lots of stuff happening in the industry. You know, your first comment has got the year off to a flying start. So very interesting, really exciting industry to be part of.
And within the media brands family, it's worth sort of spelling out, I guess, the two big names that people would most know would be UM and Initiative.
Yep.
Let's take them one at a time. So I guess the big recent move, which I guess he'll have had time to bed in now, is Matt Baxter heading up UM.
Yep.
How's that going?
I'm thrilled. I was thrilled when Matt and I started talking and he came on board. What I've seen Matt do is really hit the ground running. He is a really exciting person to work with. I've seen the whole business at UM really engage with, you know, what he's about, and vice versa. I've seen a really different side to Matt now that he has been given an opportunity to take on a CEO role of a much bigger business than he has in the past. And I think we will see and hopefully be announcing some really positive things as a result of Matt's joining.
And I suppose one of the hard things for you must be, because it was your baby, you were the boss of UM before doing this,
yep.
Is sitting on your hands and not being, you know, not getting involved in some agency things that you know must be going on around you. Must be quite a hard adjustment, I should think.
It's a really good point you make, Tim. I thought that would really be difficult. One, because that whole sort of notion of, you know, was it my baby? I think what has transpired is a realization that it wasn't my baby. Every member of the team at UM owns UM. And I think that's one of the things that I've seen Matt really be refreshed by, and in that it's not a one person proposition. To the credit of the broader team and also to Matt, I'm still very involved. I'm still very energized by what's happening at UM, and I'm involved where I need to be. But I'm sort of fortunate enough to have a guy like Matt and of Matt's caliber stepping in and really taking the reins and running. So it's actually great. It's really changed my interaction with UM. It hasn't really diminished. It's just a whole different side of UM that I'm interfacing with now.
And how about Initiative? How's Initiative going?
I'm really pleased with how Initiative's going, actually. We sort of stepped in and made some changes to Initiative at a time when Initiative was actually having some difficulties. Tracy's come on board and very much stabilised the business. We've retained a number of pieces of business that were dangling for a little while. And, you know, as recently as yesterday, I sat down with the executive team at Initiative and was blown away at the level of activity and the level of sort of proactive growth initiatives, pardon the pun, that the team has put in place. Initiative has just embarked globally on a whole new attitude and positioning, all centered around performance, which really fits the capabilities of the team at Initiative and really the market that we're that we're sort of operating in. And I'm more than pleased with where things are at.
And what do you mean by performance?
Well, I think performance is a really, really broad but relevant factor in our industry now. And you know, whether it's strategic performance or ROI performance or the performance of individuals, the performance of a relationship, all of those elements all center back to, as an agency and as a business, our role is to create solutions that perform for our clients in a number of different ways. So, you know, initiatives really harnessed that thought and is really leveraging that internally and with a number of clients around the world and obviously with a number of clients here in Australia. You know, we're doing some really exciting stuff for clients like Hyundai and Kia. The work we're doing with Bunnings is, in my view, some of the best retail work we're seeing. And you know, we've partnered Bunnings in a whole new sort of transition in their business as they start to get you know, more aggressive about a different marketplace that they're in. So, you know, really exciting performance-based work.
On performance, how seriously do you take the RECMA rankings?
That's a good question. I think the RECMA rankings are an even playing field measure. Like any sort of independent measure, there are always elements of an agency's performance that are very, very difficult to really gauge. And I think whether it's RECMA or even the Nielsen Billings you know, benchmarks, there are always elements that are missed and in a positive and a negative sense in many ways. So, you know, we take the RECMA, we look at the RECMA rankings and the ratings and the the vitality score, and you know, we sort of put some context to that to ourselves with what we know of our business. So, you know, they're an important measure. They're probably the only real global agency measure, and they fulfill a role. We work pretty collaboratively with RECMA and share everything we can so that they have as transparent a view on what is actually going on. But, you know, that's what we do.
I remember one agency boss saying to me that the thing is his argument, and he hadn't done terribly well in the RECMA rankings right. That year, I think. His argument was, you know, they come in once a year, they sit down in the office, and let's say for the sake of argument, he had 100 staff. They'd say, how many staff have you got? So he'd say 200, and they'd write it down. It would appear in the report as 200 staff. So I suppose that's the issue is you know, you touch on transparency. Is RECMA is only as good as the industry allows it to be, really, I guess.
I think there's some truth to that. But to... In defence of RECMA, I think over the last few years in particular, I've noticed that they are much more diligent about their information gathering. They're not taking, you know, the agency source as the only source. They're verifying, you know, that information because it's in their interest to. You know, if they're providing reports that are completely out of whack, the market will know. And you know, the agencies subscribe to that, but also a number of the multinational clients that also have a good feel for the market, you know, utilize that information. So I think, you know, RECMA is a fair measure, but not the only measure.
Well, the other, one of the other brands within the media brands family is Reprise, which my sense is probably within your group, Search sits a little bit more closely to the other parts of the industry than perhaps it does elsewhere. So, you know, Reprise, you know, does feel that it's at least related to the media agency.
You bet. That's very, very intuitive of you, Tim. It's a great question too. Reprise in our business has been and is a key catalyst for a broader reevaluation of really agnostic communications and thinking agnostically about comms. Search, whether it's paid or organic or even now, you know, Reprise is heavily focused on social media now. Those channels are key channels to modern day communications because of how consumers engage with those platforms and channels. Reprise is in the middle, at the beginning, at the end of most of the work we do. It's a business within Media Brands, but it is completely integrated into every team and every client that we service and create solutions for. And because of that, is one of the fastest growing businesses within Media Brands. You know, an interesting fact we're really, really pleased with is that Reprise is the fastest growing search business in Australia. You know, it's Google's fastest growing partner. And, you know, we're growing at about a bit more than twice the rate of every other search partner in the country. And that includes the market leaders like Columbus, like Outrider, downstream and you know, the players that we see as our competitors.
And one thing that does strike me about the search industry is there still is a real mixture in the quality of the people doing the work. There's some really smart people and some people who are almost pirates. Now, a slight declaration of interest, Reprise, you might not have been aware, we've actually been a client of Reprise.
Yes, I am aware, and
found them absolutely brilliant, clever people to the extent that I would recommend them to anyone. But elsewhere in the industry, I've found some people taking big chunks of money off clients for some pretty hopeless search work. Do you think it's a part of the industry that is maybe still a little bit kind of Wild West?
I think your comment applies to every part of our industry. There are creative agencies that are really professional and really strategic and really add value, and there are creative outfits that aren't. Same in the media agency space, in the PR space. In any category, there is the good, the average, and the bad. And people are getting, you know, people's businesses live and die, you know, on how good or how long they're getting away with it.
And that's the thing.
I was going to say, it depends on who you've got kind of leading the charge. And you guys have got Andrew Hughes.
We have Andrew Hughes. Is one of our key executives within the social and SEO space. Yeah.
Well, he spoke at Digital Citizens a number of months back, and you know, I found him to be absolutely spot on. Every time I ever spoke to him about that kind of stuff, he seems like probably the best in Sydney, if not Australia.
We think that too.
Yeah, there you go.
He's a fantastic person. Which
yes,
is
without
part of
too much of an Andrew Hughes love in, I have to say that yes, I found him incredibly smart as well. You'll be able to follow him on Twitter. I think it's at Yozza, isn't it?
Yeah, Y0ZZA.
That's right. Yeah.
Robin, you were very diligently making a note as if you were about to ask a question.
It's just because earlier on this morning I was working on a story about the launch of a new search business up in Brisbane. So I was just wondering, I was just making notes about perhaps what makes a good search professional. I mean, what are the qualities you look for when you're hiring a good search person?
That's a very narrow question to a very broad proposition. Search is not about one person. Search is about a team of people with different skills coming together to provide highly technical capabilities. Search is a very strategic part of our business. I think what we've noticed from our competitive set is that a lot of the search operators are very technical, very administrative. But when you filter search via a very strategic lens and have search introduced into a solution at the very beginning, it's a much more organic and seamless channel. And it plays a role as opposed to acting as a safety net in a lot of cases. So for us, I look at the Reprise team, you know, led by David Fernandez, with the likes of, you know, Rebecca Tiles, Andrew, and a number of other really talented people with complementary skills. And that doesn't just apply to search. I think search is still relatively new in broader terms, but that goes the same for what we're doing within the media agencies. You know, a group of people who complement each other create a fantastic all-around solution, as opposed to two or three headstrong or very ego-driven or really, really clever or creative people who are too far ahead of everybody else. So that's sort of been our strategy for engaging people into our business. And that has been applying a filter of how will this person work in terms of what we need as a capability within the business, and how are they going to work with the people that are already there, the people that we're thinking about bringing as well, and most importantly, how are they going to work with our clients and the clients' business and what their needs are, because that's really where the rubber hits the road. And we've been fortunate. We've had more successes than fails, and it's something we're constantly keeping an eye on.
Well, before we talk about the week's media events, we should briefly catch up with Scott as well, which shows how fast these things are. It's only a fortnight since you were last in with us, and on that podcast we were introducing you as the VP of Digital Media at Fleischmann Hillard.
And we were pimping my new website, Kilt for Hire, ironically
yes,
enough.
Yes, ironically enough. So I suppose the most obvious question is what happened?
I just got called into the office at the end of the day, and they said, your position's redundant. It's a business decision from on high, and that's it. So I packed up my stuff. I took my stuff off, deleted stuff from my computer, walked outside, and then watched my iPhone and iPad get wiped. So I couldn't even phone anybody at that moment. So there's a little lesson about working with big corporates. They've got if you use their Exchange email system on your phone, they can wipe it the moment you walk out of the business.
Interesting.
So I was like, shit. Because I literally could not call or tweet or do anything. So it's kind of bizarre.
Now, one question I did have was, obviously it was, as you say, it was a business decision. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you said nice things about them and they said nice things about you. You were probably one of the most senior people within a PR agency who'd come from, you know, a social media meets PR background. Yep. Does it say something about the industry as a whole and the ability of the industry to support that sort of role, that social media is just not big enough as a revenue stream?
My role wasn't social media, it was digital. So it was encompassing all aspects of online for brands, really. You know,
sure.
That included SEO, SEM. We also looked at their websites. We did, you know, an analysis of the kind of, I suppose, a snapshot of what the brand was like online, that kind of stuff. Monitoring digital crisis comms. You know, social media was just a small aspect of that. And I think there's other agencies, you know, growing in strength from that. Ogilvy just is hiring, I think, 6 in their digital 360 team at the moment. You know, I think that the Edelman's growing their team. I just think that, you know, as was said in the article, Fleischmann's lost staff recently. There's been some turmoil, and I think, you know, when that happens, you know, sometimes you just got to look at the numbers and then chop from the top of the bottom.
What's your next plan for you?
There's a number of irons in the fire, I think is probably the best way to describe it. There's a few things ongoing. Literally in the last 2 weeks, I haven't stopped. I've been in meetings and interviews and catch-ups and coffees, and I probably had more hot chocolates in the last 2 weeks than I intend to have for the rest of my life. There's a few things going, and you know, there's one thing that's it's actually really interesting to me, and it's the one that there's probably three I'm really intrigued about, and one of them especially so, and I think I might find out about that today or tomorrow. So, you know,
what sort of position are you going for?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to tell you something, but I can at the moment. I'm along for an interview, second part of an interview the other week, and they sat down and they said to me, and it was an agency, and I said, do you know what? I said, I'm going to be completely, my cards on the table here. I said, I don't even know if I want to work in agency anymore. I said, so I've just been honest with you that I'm here to talk to you. And it was a strange one, because literally I went in to meet the staff and they brought the entire office into the boardroom to meet me. And I had to do a kind of pitch to the whole team. So there was like 14 people in the room, which was, you know, unexpected and hasn't happened to me before.
I remember an episode of Entourage where that happened.
It's kind of weird, trust me on this one. But it was good, you know, it was good. I decided not to do like a presentation. I actually just went and talked about what they wanted me to talk about. You know, I'm not sure if I want to do as much agency. The problem is sometimes, even if you choose the right agency, they might not have the ability to sustain you, or there might be other problems underlying that you don't know about. And then, you know, do I want to go in-house? Do I want to change the kind of role I'm going at, more like an online marketing manager? So there's a lot of different areas.
So what's your dream job, ideally, if you could create a role for yourself?
Dream job? I don't know. Male gigolo? Servicing all the... I don't think there is such a thing as a dream job. I think there's a job which you're happy with and you feel as though you're making a difference. And I think, you know, the journalist in me still thinks it. We can make a difference. And I think when I moved into public relations, because I thought the closer I am to the source, the bigger difference we can make rather than just writing about it.
Well, next we'll be talking where public relations meets media. Now, we saw that OMD this week became, I think, the first media agency to appoint someone with PR experience to lead its strategy. That man is Alastair Henderson, who used to head up sister-branded content agency Fuse. In a former life, he was director of consumer communications at PR agency Hill & Knowlton. Now, Henry, this is a kind of interesting one because I suspect that the reason that he was promoted was because he was the right man for the job and he was already there on the spot. But the way OMD has announced it certainly seems to suggest to me that they're becoming increasingly interested in what they describe as earned media. Is this something that media agencies are actually going to have to kind of get their heads around increasingly? Because, you know, my impression has always been, certainly ad agencies, and I'd probably make the argument media agencies as well, don't really get PR.
I think that's maybe a little harsher criticism. I'm a big fan of OMD. I think Lee and Hawgs are really smart operators. I think the decision to appoint Alastair is a clever and it's a future facing decision. Really simple from that perspective. I think I can't really speak for the creative agencies, but I know that in the media sector, the whole notion of earned media is real. A lot of the agencies that our agencies compete with, we know, do understand that space, are doing great things with social media specialties, also with PR agencies. I think what the guys at OMD have sort of done in appointing Alastair is sort of signified that the media agency now is, has the strength, the confidence to make these appointments because it's what they're doing. So is it a surprise? Not at all. Is it smart? Very smart. Will it work? I'd be surprised if it doesn't. And I think it's a signal to the broader marketplace that communications are not to be siloed into specific buckets that they were 30 years ago,
yeah,
when the buckets were first created, and PR for that matter is one channel. It's definitely part of earned media in our view, but it can also be part of owned, and also can be part of paid depending on how and where you come at it from. So I think it's an evolution. It's a really good step in evolution.
Yeah.
I was going to say it's a convergence we've been seeing, I think, especially in the US a lot more, in the UK, and I think it's but we've been talking about it on here for the last 2 years pretty much, that the agencies need to realise they need an aspect of every form of communication within their business.
And when you've worn, wearing your PR hat, what has your experience been when you've had to deal with media agencies? Do they actually have an understanding of the opportunities and limitations?
From a public relations standpoint, one of the biggest problems we ever face is advertising agencies, because they come up with a campaign, they speak to the market manager goes, we love it. Market manager then goes to the PR manager and says, we want PR for this. And the PR people go, we can't PR that. That's crap. That's totally not the way to go. And there's this discord between the marketing and the PR managers a lot of the time. You see it successfully where the PR market manager are either the same person or they've actually worked together to create something. But the discord, the amount of there's one company who I won't name who I've worked with, and the advertising agency would give us nothing, not a single thing. And every time that we spoke to the market manager, be like, oh, well, I've told them to tell you, so they should be telling you. Why have you not done your strategy for the year? Why have you not done your planning? And we're like, we don't know what they're doing and we can't do it. And then they held it off to the point that we lost a client. When it went to a new agency, I spoke to somebody at the new agency a while back and they said, same problem. Can't get anything done because and they are actually part of the same company, which is even worse. And it just happens all the time. There's a battle between PR and advertising simply because advertising have the big dollars, the big spend, and can do what they want, whereas PR is seen as this second rate thing. And there was always a thing where PR would be said, 5% of your budget should be public relations. But the fact is, it needs to be more than that if you're wanting there's so many campaigns out there that don't get a lot of traction because they don't get pushed out. They just get advertising behind it and that's it. But, you know, people trust a lot more what they read, and that's where PR comes in. You have to utilise all factors of communication to push your message out.
Robin. In a media agency, this is a question for Henry. In a media agency, where does PR sit in if there's a hierarchy of media? Scott was talking about when advertising agencies, PR is perhaps belittled sometimes. Where do you see PR sitting in a hierarchy of media?
Well, I think the simple answer to that is it's really, really important because it's, you know, it's a form of, you know, it's a way to generate earned media, and within the media agencies, because we are very focused on the consumer, we do a lot of due diligence on, you know, what is this human being thinking? What buttons do we need to push for this human being to engage? We, you know, we've got a number of research pieces and ongoing when we go to research, word of mouth, you know, driven by PR or at some sort of stimulant is always in the top three. So, you know, over the last 4 or 5 years as media agencies, we keep, you know, our own research that we commission ourselves is telling us PR is very important. And it really plays into the notion of the media industry and the broader communications industry starting to talk about paid, owned and earned, because they are, that's the holy trinity in comms. And to belittle one or to pedestal another is a good way to get the balance wrong. Mm. And that's when campaigns go.
Yeah. And bad. You need everybody to work together.
Because
ultimately you're all working towards the same common goal, and that's helping the client out.
That's right.
And
what this phenomenon has actually really done is not so much tested capability. It's actually tested the ability to share your toys. Mm. And ultimately is the best work is being created and developed by the least paranoid in the market. So the more paranoid you are, the less you're going to collaborate and the worse the work is going to be.
Well, yep. Next, the battle of 10 and 7.
So since the news broke that James Warburton was taking over at 10, it's got nasty. 7, his current employer, released an affidavit last week arguing that it will not be able to start at 10 until July and will in fact have to wait until October 2012. It's by no means certain what will happen next, but they're back in court on April the 4th. Tim, you wrote about this last week. What do you think will happen?
I don't know, is the honest answer.
He might have to take a year and a half off work.
Well, the issue of the the issue of the legal argument is based on a couple of things: what his employment contract says, and also the management share scheme, which seemed to involve a separate sort of non-compete. So that appears to be at the centre of it. I must admit, I've followed a couple of quite interesting HR debates involving other media companies, but not TV companies, where they've gone to court after someone over a non-compete. And you do get the sense that sometimes they're enforceable, even when an everyday person might see as some sort of, you know, unfair restriction. So I'm not at all certain that he will start in July, but that, you know, and that's why they're going to court to resolve it, because both sides want to resolve it really quickly. And I suppose then just the question comes, the longer the wait goes on, the more uncertainty there is in the market.
What do you think the implications are for the TV landscape overall if there is this period of a year and a half that he has to wait until he takes over? Henry, you know, tens of clients, so perhaps you can't talk in too much detail, but what's your perspective on how it'll affect the TV landscape overall?
I think it goes without saying, every company needs to have leadership in place and on the ground and operating. So, you know, if the courts were to decide for James to be kept out of 10 for longer than that, it means that the 10 network has to wait longer to get the expected engagement and traction that, you know, they're hoping for James to deliver on. At a broader market, what's really interesting from my perspective is the news of James leaving 7 to go to 10 was the news for a good week to 2 weeks. But business goes on. you know, marketers are still needing to reach audiences, and you know, brands still need viewers to tune in to watch programs so that that message can be conveyed. So I think it's a disruption. It's very internal in its nature. I would imagine that not having things finalized and set for both networks, and also for the Nine network, I think, you know, it's not just Seven and Ten. It's actually all media, because the television sector is a pretty influential and dominant sector within broader comms. It's a little destabilizing, but the market needs to keep moving forward, and I think it will. It has. It's already, you know, everything's sort of business as usual.
Now, this is very, it's funny how quickly these things become ancient history. You know, it's only, I guess, a fortnight or 3 weeks ago that there were three names publicly in the fray, in which was Hamish McLennan's name was bandied around, James Warburton's name was bandied around, and your name was bandied around. Was that market speculation correct? Were there any interesting conversations?
It was market gossip. It wasn't speculation. And I think actions speak louder than words. I have been turning up to 166 William Street right along this process. So it was just gossip. I have a good understanding where that gossip may have come from, but nothing that surprises me. But no.
Is it one of those never say never things? Could you one day see yourself media owner side, for instance? Because it's a route that others have taken. I'm thinking of James Warburton, for instance, as the classic example.
Listen, I am someone that says never say never, but I'm not saying, just for the record, and I hope you don't edit this out.
You're not saying never, but never say never, just to get our triple negatives.
I never say never, because that would be really silly. You never know what's around the corner. But I can tell you categorically that I'm not going to Channel 7, which was the last phone call I got.
I hadn't even heard that rumour.
Well, that was for someone else at another media organisation. And, you know, the 10 news was merely speculation. And that's gossip, actually. And that's it, really. So sorry to disappoint.
Next, disaster coverage, the battle for credit.
So the issue of the coverage of disasters has been a topic of discussion more than once on this podcast. We've had the Queensland floods, we've had Cyclone Yasi, we've had the Christchurch earthquake, and of course now the Japanese earthquake and tsunami. Now, the ABC was criticised for its initial coverage, or lack thereof, of the Japan disaster. This is particularly ABC News 24. Instead, rerunning other content, other news and documentary content, some of it, you know, 2 or 3 years old, over that first weekend. So it defended itself, saying that it was covering all of the significant goings on in Japan and rebroadcasting BBC News 24 and Japanese public broadcaster NHK when it could. And on the Friday night when all of this happened, so only a week ago, actually ABC News 24 was the most watched digital channel, which is the first time it's happened. Sky News then jumped in saying that it had won in homes that had pay TV, and it all became a slightly distasteful conversation, really. What do you think, Scott? How has this been handled by the media generally?
I think it's pretty horrible to jump in and say, oh, by the way, we did better coverage of a disaster than you. Ultimately, you know, I flicked through every channel to see what the coverage was like. To the end of it, I got to that point, which is typical, I suppose, having been a journalist and having seen it. It just feels so repetitive constantly. I realise that you're there so you can update whoever just drops in and drops out, but you know, you don't have to continually show it again. And that I've seen the footage of that water hitting the village, I must have seen it about 190 times now. And you know, I saw a psychologist talking about how that affects people that actually witness this over and over and over, and it desensitizes a lot of people. And having worked in the media and been involved in disasters, you know, you do become desensitized.
So which disasters? Because you worked for News Corp, News Limited over here, News International.
There was different ones we worked on. I mean, just you can go from small ones to bigger ones. I mean, we had bad flooding. We had, you know, massive house fires where whole families were wiped out, that kind of stuff. You know, when you get involved in all that and you speak to neighbours, and you know, you're. I mean, there was one situation where I had to cover a woman trapped in a car and the car caught fire and, you know, she died in the car in front of us. You know, it's these things can get to you when, you, when you're doing that kind of thing. And watching all the coverage, I just found that the one I find the bizarrest is Hamish McDonald, is it?
Who's
Channel 10's. You know, he reminds me frighteningly of Damien Day from Drop the Dead Donkey.
He was the one who would always have the teddy bear.
And every time I've watched him now involved in all the footage, he's you know, his cameraman pans out and he's like, family photos, abandoned prams, you know, child's toy line. And
there is the subtle difference there that I don't think he would have planted
those. He's not placing them and stuff. But it just feels like he's pushing for an award or something, the way he's trying to do it, trying to convey this human emotion. But to be honest, the picture tells itself. The camera, you know, the camera showing the house on top of another house, a car smashed into it, and rubble strewn everywhere, that sells the story. You know, that's telling everybody what happened. Everybody knows. I don't think you need to push it down people's throats. Yes, families were wiped out. Yes, you know, people are missing. And the video footage of the family reuniting that I've seen, I don't know how many times now, is horrendous. It's heartbreaking to see. And I don't think it needs to be shoved in our faces.
Henry, did you watch much of the coverage
over the
weekend?
I did. I watched it because I was just shocked at the scale of the disaster. I think that's if I'm critical at all on all the broadcasters, I feel as though there isn't a lot being really done about really expressing the scale. And the best way to do that is by showing some respect to that.
Yeah.
You know, that I think Scott's right. That loop of, okay, here comes that wave hitting the village again, is desensitizing. And really, in a situation like this, the idea, in my view, for good news coverage is to not desensitize, and to keep engagement and you know.
Something else I felt as though they missed was there wasn't enough push for you can help out by doing this. There wasn't, I didn't feel as though I saw any of that. This whole donate to the Red Cross, you know, if you want to donate clothes, you want to do something. I just didn't feel there was any drive on any of the channels.
I have noticed that message is starting to come back in a little bit more now.
The coverage has also become a little bipolar. So is the issue about the nuclear reactors or is it about the loss of life? And in the first few days, it was like, oh, my God, this thing's happened. Yes. This is thousands of people feared missing. And it quickly became these nuclear reactors, ticking time bomb. And for it felt for me at least that, hold on a sec, guys, there's lots of people who have been sort of vanished off the earth. And I now feel that it's now starting to swing back in. You know, holy shit, there's thousands and thousands of people missing.
Yeah.
What it really reinforces is just how terrible the situation is.
I'm not sure you can blame broadcaster for repeating those images. It's sort of the same with 9/11. I do see what you've seen. It becomes almost disaster porn. Keep replaying the same things, extraordinary images, and they're compelling images. You can't break away from them. You can't stop watching them. And the Asian tsunami, I think the only reason there wasn't such footage is because they didn't have cameras there. They had had helicopters in Japan and were able to get such extraordinary images, that's why they kept
the
blame.
I just think it's been too much, though. And I'd say the same with the amount of bloody experts have wheeled out who are going on about reactors and
the professors.
Oh, and you know, do you know what? It seems that I haven't seen any of them right so far, pretty much. They're all over the place, you know. And some of the footage in the US is quite terrible, I'll have to admit.
Well, next on a slightly more mundane detail of the return of Chris Lilly.
You're listening to the Mumbrella Cast. For more on all these stories, go to mumbrella.com.au.
Nathan! Nathan's my identical twin brother. He's deaf. He's a little bit retarded too.
My car is a manual. My name is Daniel.
Because he's deaf, he can't hear himself taking a dump.
Cops, they like us because we sort of keep an eye on the town. Tell it's a fag dog, right? Wiggles its bum when it walks. You can see it's nuts.
I'm not fucking crying! Why don't you go kill yourself, Lezo?
When I first brought him over to Tokyo, he complained constantly. Oh, I miss my friend. I miss my school.
I told you I don't rack pork.
I homeschooled Tim.
How do you not know that?
I knew that when I was 6 years old. Being the mother of a gay son...
Oh, look at the balls on that guy.
...come with his own problems.
Tim, shut up. I'm on the phone.
Oh. Someone been a little piggy this week.
We've had an introduction to Australian mockumentarian Chris Lilley's latest series, Angry Boys, which is co-produced with American network HBO and has already been bought by the BBC. Now, we're pretty used to Lilley's pushing the boundaries with previous series We Can Be Heroes and Summer Heights High, which both rated well for the ABC. Again, it looks like he'll leave no politically incorrect stone unturned. Scott, do you think he's pushing it too far for an American-British crowd? And what about Aussies?
I don't know if he's pushing it too far. I just personally can't stand his work. I think he's shit. That's my personal opinion. I can't stand his shows. Tried watching another two, hated them. Saw a clip for this, hated it. I just find him to be, I suppose we could call him a one-trick pony. But I really don't find him funny. I think he's, you know, and I can watch, you know, I can watch Drawn Together, which is possibly the most incorrect program I've ever seen in my entire life, and I can laugh at it. But whenever I watch his stuff, I feel as though it misses a higher level of humor. It reminds me, it feels like he's trying to attain a Chris Morris status, the UK kind of. Satirist, I suppose, would be the way to term. I mean, he did the whole program trying to get celebrities to talk about a new drug called cake and getting them to say, you know, don't eat cake, you know, it's bad for you. But I personally can't stand the guy. Can't stand anything he does. There you go.
He's clearly gunning for PC culture, but many comedians have done that, haven't they? Ricky Gervais, which we talked about earlier in The Office, also does a similar thing.
Go all the way back to, you know, Bill Hicks, you know, keep going back. You know, it's not a hard target, really. But I just find it feels dirty, if that makes any sense. It doesn't feel like clever comedy. It just feels like cheap comedy.
Henry,
I'm not a very big fan. I've seen some of his work with in his previous work, but really, I think, you know, some people will like it, some people, you know, will hate it. Some people will be indifferent. I'm probably indifferent on it. What it really speaks to is what creators and you know, the creative community is really now toying around with is new. And I think that's really come out in the last 24 months, you know, new types of content like Glee, you know, Modern Family is a really interesting twist in comedy. You know, I think this is potentially something that is being experimented with by Chris that is just new, and it could find its niche. Mm. And really, to succeed, all you need to find is a niche. And you know, working with HBO, that's not a bad option.
I have to admit, when I saw that, I was a bit quite, because I find everything that HBO does fantastic.
So do I.
Yeah, and I'm really enjoying Eastbound and Down at the moment.
Yeah.
And what's it called? Broad thing we Empire, what was it called? Boardwalk Empire. That's just amazing, you know, Steve Buscemi. But yeah, sorry, not sold in this one.
Next, the narcotic that is social media.
So we had a guest posting on Mumbrella this week from the Works director Douglas Nichol. He's been at the South by Southwest conference in Texas. Now, he suggested that social media has become a crack cocaine habit for some marketers, with an obsessive focus on pushing random consumers to like or to follow their brand. But no one can actually say whether it's working or not. Scott, it feels like we've been having this conversation forever, so let's not have it for too long now. But can you ever tie social media to real marketing outcomes?
I think you can, you know. I think you just have to get the things in place that you do it with. You know, can you tie an ad? Does somebody visit a Facebook page, do they go buy a product, or do they see an advert and go buy a product? I mean, you know, if you're going to weigh it up like that, what's it going to come to? I think that you can do it. I just think it's going to take longer because, you know, what you're doing, social media is about conversations. You know, and it's about ambassadors, and it's about creating this community for people who may not go out and spend more on your product, but may also be the people that tell others to go try your product, or who you know are willing to defend you on a forum, on a website. I don't know, but you know, it's not just about that sale. I think most of the social media where it's became really useful has been in customer service. You know, and if your customers are happy, then you're likely to, you know, do better for your business. There is a good blog called metricsman.blogspot, I think it is. And it's run by one of the guys in the US from Flashman Hillard. And it's a great blog to look at metrics and ROI on on social media. And
ROI, we've already talked about ROI from your point of view, Henry. Do you have a sort of any skepticism when it comes to social media and where it meets marketing?
Not at all. I know Douglas. He's a very smart man. I think it's important to point out that Douglas's roots are as a direct marketer. In fact, he was nominated Direct Marketing Person of the Year a number of times.
He's a chaired ABMA as well, hasn't he?
And he has, yeah. And he's a good guy, really smart guy. I think his comments may come from the fact that as a pure play direct marketer, or at least his origins are, he is grappling with social media because it's not direct marketing. It's actually indirect marketing. Mm. And it's really where brands, can be direct, but also can be indirect via, advocates and through the social movement. So is it measurable? Yes, we've got too many examples of how social media is measurable. And the measures are not always positive. They're negative. And part of, I think, the next era of marketing is going to be around brands dealing with the truth. And the truth sometimes, in a lot of cases, is negative consumer sentiment. And how they deal with that potentially creates positive outcomes. So, it really speaks to the broader advertising fraternity getting real with itself and through the eyes of the consumer, finally.
That is all we have time for today. Thanks to our guest, Scott Rohde.
Thanks, Tim.
And Media Brands' Henry Tager.
Thanks, Tim.
And to my co-host, Robin Hicks.
Thanks, Tim.
Production was by Alice Terlikovsky. Next week, we welcome back to the studios of CBS Interactive, PhD Strategy Director, Chris Stevenson. I'm Tim Burrows, and that was the Mumbrella Cast. Toodle-pip.